Hello, this is Johnny Moore in London.
This is Rob Patterson in Prince Edward Island, Canada.
Hi, and this is Neil Perkin in London as well.
And this is a podcast on the subject of agility and agile planning, prompted really because Neil here wrote a very interesting post about agile planning a few days ago. And one of the aspects of it that interested me is I've been writing a bit lately about other buzz phrases like empowerment and engagement, and writing rather sceptically about them, because I think these things are often talked about much more than they're actually practiced. And I think that was kind of the tone that you were taking with your post as well.
Yeah, agile is an interesting word because it tends to get overused quite a lot. And I think clearly businesses view agile processes as a way of getting productivity gains in their business. Whereas the point about the post that I wrote was very much about the fact that it's a philosophy, I think, that people need to adopt as much as it is about a process. And that it was prompted by a couple of things, I guess. One is that in my background in a media owner, we implemented what you might call agile development techniques in the digital team there. And it transformed the way that not only that team worked, but also the way that other teams around the business interface with them and the way that they worked, because the way of working was a lot more iterative, and actually the kind of whole philosophy behind it kind of changed the way in which the business was working. And I suppose my point really about the post was that the kind of traditional business processes that businesses have about setting big goals, budgeting on lengthy cycles, and having very kind of rigid objectives and rigid structures and processes doesn't necessarily work in today's very fluid and agile environment, where things change very rapidly and become out of date very quickly, and businesses just need to be a lot more adaptable to the kind of change that is going on out there.
Yeah, I grew up business-wise in a big bank, and every project was kind of 5 years and $50 million.
Yeah.
And the process was that you kind of had to get it all built and nailed down, and then you would reveal it to the public and the users. And I don't think it really worked very well back in the day. And certainly today, when we're dealing with issues that we don't understand, I think a lot of, for instance, huge debate in America on healthcare. And it boiled down to, we'll take the system for granted that pills, doctors, hospitals and everything are the way forward. And then the issue is, how can we get more people access? But that isn't really, that really isn't the issue anymore, that we're beginning to understand that our health is driven by all sorts of very complicated things, most of which are about your economic position in the hierarchy and how you live and how you're connected and things like that. And it will not be possible for you, me, or Johnny to know what the new system will be. No one's clever enough. And this process, you used, I think, the key word of iteration, is the only way you can discover the really new, which is you've got to sit around the campfire and talk about stuff and try things, and then talk about them again and try them again. And I think that is a philosophy, isn't it? Neil, that's how I see it as well, in that our main philosophy now is we can know what it is, and we can plan for the whole thing, and we can then construct it and release it. And I think you can only do that about simple things like building a 1,000-square-foot bungalow.
Mm.
But almost any of the issues that we're all confronting today, that just can't work.
Yeah, Rob, I'm remembering now why I wanted to get you onto this particular podcast. I was reminded that you wrote a post not so long ago about budgets.
Yes.
And how in the conventional organization, basically it's all about being the person with the biggest budget. That's how you rise to the top of the organization. So actually you succeed in those organizations by being, by being the biggest and probably the clumsiest part of the organization. You actually get no brownie points for the more agile, low-cost, faster, experimental approach.
Absolutely. And in fact, if you try that, you're going to fail. For instance, a family member, I have to be careful, used to work for a large oil company and ran their wind issue. And they did a couple of big projects. But compared to oil, the return on these projects was pathetic. And they could never go into renewables, really, because the big money and the big budget was lodged in oil. And so it becomes impossible to innovate in those circumstances.
Yeah, I think the thing I'd add about budgets as well is that the process of budget setting in most organisations is such a kind of laborious process. You know, it tends to happen that it's sort of built from the top down and the bottom up, and that it takes a long time for managers to kind of go through that process. Then it has to go all the way up the decision-making chain. And by the time it gets to the top and is authorised, you might have 3 or 4 months have gone past, and your market has changed, your competitive situation has changed, and I think, you know, your budget is actually out of date already. So
it is,
and yet that is the you know, what you set your objectives by for the next year, and it becomes your measures of performance for the next year as well.
Yes.
So arguably, by the time your budget gets approved, your measures of performance and your objectives are already out of date and already flawed. So I thought it was kind of interesting, because I read a piece that Office Depot, I think, in the US had done this thing where they'd started this process of rebudgeting or recutting their budgets every single month, which sounds like a dreadful process if you put it in the context of, you know, the traditional way of budgeting. But they'd actually developed this kind of agile way of doing budgeting that didn't take up too much manager's time, but enabled them to kind of react a lot more to what was going on in the market. And as a result of that, to get some initiatives off the ground that just wouldn't have got there under the auspices of the old kind of traditional way of working and the old budget.
Very interesting. Here's another way you can go there. I work for a television station, public television station in St. Louis, KETC, and they've been looking at it this way. They know that if they only stay a broadcaster, which they have been for many, many years, doing things that they've always done, that sometime in the next few years they won't be able to pay the bills. So they've been working very deliberately on finding out a new way of doing everything that will in the end enable them to pay the bills. So the project is transformation. The meta project is transformation. And projects that take them along the way are decided on or not, because the people have a feeling that this will be taking us to this new destination or not.
There's something that I read. One of the pieces that I quoted in the post that I wrote was an IBM report, where they produced this kind of report where they interview over 1,000 CEOs globally around the world for every couple of years or so. One of the kind of big findings after the last one that they did was about the pace of change and how many CEOs actually felt that their organizations were just not set up to cope with the pace of change that they felt they were about to face, which is quite a serious thing if you think about it. But they used this phrase, which was about innovation, and they were saying that the CEOs felt that they needed to innovate beyond customer imagination, and that they were actually wanted businesses which were hungry for change. And that's kind of interesting, because, you know, the way businesses are kind of set up at the moment, I wouldn't say that many big businesses are set up to deliver beyond customer imagination or are even set up to be hungry for change. They might react to change, but reacting to change is very different from being hungry for change, I'd say.
I would go further, Neil. I'd say most businesses today are actually set up to not change. So you see this in the school system. You see this in the conventional media. People are fighting. They'd rather die. They'd rather kill the newspaper that they all work for or own than change. I think this change thing is bullshit. I ask the question, change for what? And I think most people today can look at almost any enterprise, both for profit or not, and go, the way the world is going, if we stay the same, will we survive? And the answer to that, in most cases, if you were honest with yourself, would be no. So rather than, I think, talking about change or impressing people, I think a better question is, are we going to survive or not the way we are? And if we don't think we will, what have we got to do?
Yeah, I'd agree with that. You know, if you just look at the competitive landscape, the fact that many organisations don't, you know, they don't know who their competitors are going to be, you know, next year or in 2 years' time, because it's probably going to be some startup which is happening in some garage somewhere right now. And it's going to be a company that they've never heard of. It's not going to be the kind of lumbering corporate that they traditionally kind of market share against. and that they've known for a long time, and they kind of know how they're going to react, and it's all very much a known quantity. I think we're entering into a very different kind of era where it's just not about that anymore.
I tweeted on YouTube this morning by a guy called Dan Brown, not the Da Vinci Code Dan Brown, but a student from Nebraska. He's a very successful YouTuber. I think he's got like 100,000 subscribers, and he decided quite recently to quit college. And he did a really fantastic sort of 6 or 7 minute diatribe on why the education institutions are out of date, and if they don't change, they're going to die. And really captured very neatly how rigid, though you mentioned these education, how rigidly they're stuck in this very ancient model.
Yes.
Before, as he put it, when facts were not free. Well, facts are now virtually free, and yet most education institutions are still very stuck in the model of extremely boring lectures, pouring facts down students' throats, and then testing them to make sure that they remembered them. And I don't know if he consciously channeled Mark Twain when he said it, but he said he decided to give up schooling because it was getting in the way of his education.
Right.
And I think that's part of what's happened. We now have technology that is, I slightly hesitate to use the word empowering, but I think it potentially is empowering millions of us to do stuff on our own that we used to rely on institutions for. And we're now just getting a lot more nimble. And
yes.
The way that we've organized organizations doesn't reflect that change is happening.
I think you've nailed it, Johnny. I think that's really it. If you go to your college and you have Professor Patterson, a third-rate physics professor, and you're paying all these fees, and you can get the best physics guy in the world for free on YouTube at MIT, there's something wrong here, isn't there? Even if, you know, that's assuming that lectures are how you do it.
Yeah. Well, I think I may have said this on another podcast, but I remember when Berkeley put their lectures online. I said, oh, that's good. They're putting their lectures online. But you should see some of the lectures. They're so dire. They're unbelievably. You watch some professor doing an anatomy class. That's one I picked at random. And you have to watch while she laboriously chalks out the spelling of upper vertebrae or something like that, and you're kind of watching paint dry, and that's the online product, and it's like, well, we don't need that, and we want to fast. Unfortunately, with the YouTube, you can fast forward through that, but it does sort of capture for me how that lecture model, I think, is one that we need to get shot of. I think it's deeply ingrained in us. I think it's what our education system has educated us more than anything. I think the idea that the way you learn is to sit in serried ranks and listen to an expert. But I think that people are beginning to realize that doesn't work anymore. And that applies to education. And my particular beef, and I'm sorry to get on my favorite hobby horse here, but the way that most conferences and business meetings are organized still revolve on that idea that we should all get in a room so that one person can bore us at great length at the speed that suits them with data, and we just get to listen.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think that the point I'd make about that, Johnny, is that I think, you know, that's the nature of conversation, isn't it? You have a conversation and things change during that conversation. So you need to actually change your position. You need to react to that. You can't be saying the same thing as you were saying 10 minutes ago. So and that's the kind of environment in which most organizations work now. They need to kind of change their position. They need to react to what's going on in a kind of live situation, which I just don't think that many businesses are set up to do.
And I think that play is an important part of conversation too. So I imagine early humans or even hominids, you know, sitting around a fire, and things, I bet, happened by accident around the fire. At a certain campsite, as we were about to move, we noticed that the soil around the fire pit had become clay, you know, it had become a big pot. Let's have a pot. You know what I mean? There was a kind of discovery.
Yes.
Or there were some rocks that we put round the fire, and funny coloured flame was coming out of it, and we found in the morning some slag. You know?
Oh, no, Rob, don't you think that they had a meeting and they said, actually, I think we need a utensils development project?
Yeah, absolutely. Let's design the wheel. You know? And so I think we've forgotten that our best, you know, I'm fiddling around with a new wonderful WordPress tool called Thematic. And I can't tell you how the website's going to turn out. I have to play with it. And even better, I'm playing with it with my son. So, you know, the two of us are playing. And as we're playing, things happen. But if we had a project, it would be ghastly. I don't even know what we're going to end up with, you see.
What you're saying about play is quite interesting there, because part of the way in which that kind of way of working works is it doesn't actually set a big, fat, hairy goal at the end of it.
Oh.
It just basically has, you know, the requirements that are set out are barely sufficient, I suppose you could say. So they're captured at a kind of very high level. So not everything is kind of detailed up front. So it allows for things to change as they go through the process. It works on kind of much shorter time scales, and they kind of iterate as they go. And, you know, it allows for things to kind of change as you go, so that the end goal might not be the one that you set out to achieve right at the beginning.
Absolutely. That's what James and I were talking about this whole weekend. We found we were disabling ourselves. I've always wanted to write this book, but a book is a frightening thing. And I've ended up saying, you know, actually in all my posts, I've actually written this book. I didn't even know it. All I've got to do now is 20 chapters of editing.
You've iterated your book there, Robert.
I've iterated my book, but I didn't even know I was writing it.
Interesting thing, I think, as well, is that it actually helps manage risk or mitigate risk, because the more that you kind of iterate, the less you're kind of committing to upfront. So actually for businesses, it makes a whole lot of sense in a fluid environment to work in this way, you know, from a risk point of view.
Yes. I have one other point about being agile, though. It matters, I think, what context you're using. So if you think that the world is going to remain approximately the same, you know, any more or faster, better than the world you live in, that governs a pathway. If you believe that our world is going to change radically in a bifurcative way, that defines change quite differently. And I think most people today think that the future is going to be a lot like today, only faster, more efficient. And I don't think that's a correct context. If you look at the last 100 years or so, in 1900, 85% of people in North America lived in rural communities. Now they live in big cities. That's a massive change. And these changes are going to happen even more quickly.
I think I'd probably go a bit further, because I think a lot of organizations, I mean, a lot of my writing focuses around marketing, communications and advertising. A lot of people that read my blog are advertising planners and so forth. And the interesting thing about that is that I think there is an industry which has really fallen behind its audience. You know, the kind of people that they're wanting to reach are further ahead than they are.
Yep.
So that's an interesting thing, isn't it? where you're playing catch up. You know, you're not even trying to anticipate. You're actually playing catch up with where your audience are.
It's just joining the dots between something, what you've just said, Neil, and what Rob was talking about a couple of minutes ago. I think it's my hunch is that a lot of the kind of bullshit that's talked about innovation makes it sound very effortful. And what it misses is that it's already happening and in quiet abundance, but they just haven't noticed. There's such an investment in being clever and knowing more that I think that vanity prevents them from actually seeing what is already there. Planning is about trying to anticipate the future, but actually a lot of the change is already happening. It's already taking place because, you know, now that more of us are effectively makers, anyone can make a video with a 100 quid flip camera. The ability to create messages is now so widely distributed that really no one can be in control of this anymore.
No.
And I think the problem for organizations, especially those that are set up around the whole notion of shareholder value, which is basically all publicly owned companies in the UK and America and in the West, they sort of ultimately exist to perpetuate themselves.
Whereas
disruptive and innovative software and all of that stuff is not about perpetuating institutions. It's actually a kind of it's a bit rhetorical to say it, but it's like I want to say to them, don't you get it? This social software is here to actually speed the creative destruction of dinosaurs. It's not actually to help dinosaurs become more agile.
I think the thing I'd add to that is you know, you're seeing some really interesting things, I think, happening around real time, you know, and real time kind of makes a lot of sense for people because, you know, why wait? If you don't have to wait, why should you wait? And so technology is now facilitating everything being real time and, you know, information or services, whatever you need. And, you know, that's quite a scary prospect, I think, for companies that are used to kind of operating an environment where it's all known and they can, you know, take time to react and plan ahead, and suddenly it's all open. You know, the kind of games off with kind of real-time feedback and real-time technology. I just think, you know, that really changes the game completely for me.
Yeah, that's a very good point, Neil, in that, you know, I've been working on my own for 15 years now, and one of the things I had to learn to do as a consultant was to match my pace to organizations, because, you know, they'd say, well, why don't we do this? And the next day I'd have it ready for them. And it would annoy the hell out of them. You know, because they would be ready in about 3 months to hear from me again. And I think corporate time is very slow, and it's getting more out of sync with the time that the rest of us live in.
I think you're right. It's the decision-making process which is really slow within organisations like that. And if you try and overlay an agile way of working and not change the decision-making processes you've got within your organisation, it's just never going to work. Because what the kind of techniques that you see in the software industry are doing, yeah, are changing the rhythm of work. So yes, they actually are changing the cycle, if you like, of working processes. And the rhythm of how an organisation, it's almost like the heartbeat of an organisation is kind of being changed so that it works to a different kind of rhythm, which is, you know, which kind of says how important it is, I suppose.
So my conclusion is that the dinosaurs are the dinosaurs, and the dinosaurs will die because power in these organisations comes through the budget process. You know, the man with the biggest budget wins. It's status and everything. And therefore, they've got a lock. The core process is a lock on power and prestige. And the people in it can't give that process up. They can't. They won't. And therefore, they will fall further and further behind and become more and more irrelevant and focus solely on defending themselves. And we're seeing this with all this copyright stuff. I mean, the people are going to copyright the days of the week soon.
Yes.
You know, you can't say Monday because we've got a copyright on Monday now. We've copyrighted life. And that's the sort of desperate measures, I think, of a dying age.
But I think hierarchy is so toxic to innovation that, yes, and organizations don't realize the extent to which it is, that once you're in a position high up in the hierarchy, the feedback that you get from people gets muted and changed because they're cautious of what they say to you. They can't help it. All these social experiments, Milgram's Stanford Prisoner Experiment, lots of stuff that Bob Sutton writes about in his blog, shows how even the smallest amount of power or change in status will change the way that people behave towards you, disrupts the information flow. And I think having a rigid hierarchy is almost guaranteed to kill playfulness. Because I think the essence of playfulness, some improv people will tell you, that really good improv and good friendships are about the ability to keep changing status. It's not about holding status. It's actually about playing with status, going up and going down, taking the lead on something for a minute and then handing off to somebody else who's better at it. And the relatively rigid hierarchies of conventional organizations are basically incompatible with playfulness, and therefore I think with really being agile.
You use the word toxic there, Drew, and I'd love the word toxic. I think it's a fantastic word. There was a phrase which I heard once, which I've used many times since, called toxic assumptions. And basically what they were talking about is the kind of assumptions that are just embedded in a business, in an organization, that everybody kind of just takes for granted. Like the fact that the change will be incremental, like the fact that they are entitled to a certain, you know, sales figure or a certain kind of market share, or that things will be, you know, relatively similar next year as they've been this year. Those are the kind of assumptions around which most businesses work. And they are toxic assumptions, because going back to something I think, Robert, you said earlier on, it's just like you're not entitled to those things, and actually things are changing and changing probably a lot more than you think.
I'm tempted to add one more to that list of toxic assumptions, and just as food for thought. I think the one that I see a lot in organizations is management buy-in. So much change gets predicated on, of course, we have to get senior management buy-in. We have to talk the language of the CEO. I think that probably kills off more change than almost anything else.
You're so right, and I'm a great believer in innovation and change just happening through, the people that are actually doing the job on the ground, in the kind of very kind of day-to-day stuff that they are doing, and the small changes that happen there, all add up to a big change. And that's what I think organizations who do want to change have got to try and enable. They've got to try and enable people to work in a different way, the kind of people who are doing those kinds of jobs.
I just wanted to come back to the hierarchy and dominance issue, because everything, Johnny, you say about organizations and Neil about the same sort of thing is true. And yet I see in organizations like Wikipedia or WordPress, you'll have in WordPress, in the end, if Matt's really concerned about something, he can put his foot down. If Jimmy Wales is really concerned about something,
yep,
he will put his foot down. But what they're concerned about is usually the health of the system, isn't it? They are concerned about what it's really doing. They're concerned about the health of the system. And they are brutal, despotic, emperors when it comes, if they see their system being threatened by toxic behavior somewhere. They don't fool around. So I'm wondering if you both like to comment on, there is some value in one or two people having a big say, and what that big say might be.
Yeah, I mean, I think I heard a definition once that Jimmy Wales, I think, talking about the Wikipedia community, and I forget which exact words he used, but I think that the gist of it is that he defined it as one part anarchy, in the sense that anybody could do, put anything on the site and it was completely open. One part democracy, because on some issues came up and they did vote on things to decide what was the right thing to do. And one part aristocracy, and yes. They were the kind of site's super users, I suppose. And then there was one part monarchy, which was kind of him. And it was almost like he was the kind of final kind of like, this is wrong, and actually I'm going to step in now when it's the right thing to do. But I like the combination of those four different elements. It's yes, almost like saying there is a role for each part of that.
I like that too. Johnny, what would you think?
I'm thinking that through. I think it's a really good sort of pushback, really, Rob. And that definitely gives me pause for thought. I'm just thinking about what Neil said about the Wikipedia, and I'm thinking aloud that there's something in that about how, perhaps like in the US Constitution, at least how it's supposed to operate with the separation of powers, there's more than one route to success in such an organization.
Yes.
You don't need necessarily to start by getting buy-in from the monarch. You have all these other channels to work with. And a constitutional monarch, in the end, can't fly totally in the face of sufficient numbers of his people who are motivated. So I think those systems do still somehow have within them enough vitality and life not to get stymied by hierarchy. And I think the other thought that occurred to me is, as you described that, Rob, it goes back to what I think Neil said right at the top of this podcast about, as I understood it, Neil, agile organizations get agile around a philosophy rather than a profit margin. And yes, I think that's what the examples you use, Rob, have in common, that those, when the despot is being despotic, it's not in pursuit of profit, it's in pursuit of the philosophy, if you like, of the belief of the system.
Yes.
So that may be part of it too.
It's kind of interesting because just going back to the kind of agile development movement in the software industry, which I sort of keep coming back to, because that is a kind of movement where these kinds of practices are actually in place already.
Yeah, it's a working model, isn't it, Neil?
Yeah, exactly. And I think the software industry has already taught other industries about a lot of things, about the value of openness and collaboration and so forth. So I think they kind of get there first. And they kind of got this thing called the Agile Manifesto, which is setting out this kind of philosophy. And it's interesting because it's very simple, but they talk about individuals and interactions over processes and tools, about outcomes, which for them is obviously about working software, over documentation and comprehensive documentation, and also about collaboration and customer collaboration over things like contract negotiation, and also responding to change over things like following a rigid plan. So those are the kind of philosophies, if you like, I think, which would capture the way of working. I think the mistake that a lot of organizations make is that they look at that and all they see is the process, and they start doing things like having the meetings and trying to work to the cycles without following the philosophy of what is around that process. If they do that, I think they'll fail.
There has to be some kind of heart in it, I think, for it to work. You can't just do it by just aping the rituals.
No.
Yeah, exactly.
Neil, I think you've I think maybe this is a good point to think of closing. I think you've nailed it. It is paint by numbers or be a painter. So one has life and the other doesn't.
I think that is a nice sweet note on which to end. Thanks very much, guys.
Fantastic.
Neil, it's really, really nice to meet you online.